You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Thursday the 17th of June 2021 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming live today at radioalbion.com because we have with us Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson from russjournal.org. Matt, good day, sir. How are you doing?
Well, I've been doing a lot of laughing because of this you know, Biden's press conference. You know, I never dreamed I'd see something this ridiculous where he says he has a handpicked group of journalists and he says so, asking him questions. It's just, it's just fodder for stand-up comics.
He has to ask permission to do things as well. I've noticed so many times now he said, have I got permission to do that? And you think, well, perhaps it's like an elderly person making a joke, but then you think, well, no, this is Biden. He really does have to ask permission for everything. Well, we said we would look at the Biden-Putin summit, but there really wasn't that much interesting that went on. There's a lot more other interesting stuff that has gone on surrounding it, particularly the geopolitical background, basically, to the summit, which is what we're going to be looking at today. Joe Biden is a veteran American politician who was part of the establishment which squandered the inheritance of wealth, prestige, and power that America had accumulated in the aftermath of the Second World War. He is the living embodiment of American political hubris, where words speak louder than results. As the senior Democrat in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, he helped oversee the post-Cold War physical expansion of NATO, void of any existential reason for doing so. In this way, he helped create the bloated edifice that exists today. 30 nations united in everything except a viable military alliance. And of course, as well as the Putin-Biden summit, we also had Biden visiting NATO and we also had G7. And of course, NATO is the uniting factor in all of that. Now, Matt, why is NATO not a viable military alliance?
Well, I mean, it wasn't, you know, a few decades ago, France dropped out of it. You have Germany refusing to follow American dictates. Brexit and the movement to leave the EU in Italy shows us tremendous disunity. The Europeans just think Americans are going to do any kind of fighting that has to be done, and so they're not going to spend much money. They're capable of great things, but they have fairly small militaries, which is what Trump got all upset about. There's really no political unity, and ultimately there's no purpose, which is what the quote you just said. It's one thing to want to fight the Soviet Union, which is, you know, which it never did. But now they're not quite sure what their purpose is. As the Chinese foreign ministry has said recently, they're going to invent an enemy. They absolutely have to invent an enemy. And that's China and Russia, depending on the day.
So everybody's pretty much just relying on America. And that's what Trump was upset about. And yet, if you look at the state of the American army, they're not really a threat to anyone, are they? It's no wonder that China and Russia are laughing at them. Well, the rise of Putin coincided with America's strategic shift from a Eurocentric power focus to pursuing regional transformation fantasies in the Middle East and South Asia, seeking to use the US military as a vehicle for nation building in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and elsewhere. This 20-year experiment has failed, leaving the US fiscally and morally bankrupt, and its military in Europe is a mere shadow of its former self in terms of capability and reach. Whereas in 1990, NATO could deploy 4 divisions to Europe in 10 days, today it takes 4 months to deploy 1 brigade. The administration of George W. Bush initiated this process with substantial assistance from the Clinton administration, and the Obama-Biden administration sustained it. While tactless and inept in his execution, Donald Trump was realistic regarding the situation he had inherited, seeking to repair relations with Russia while approaching the issue of NATO with a more realistic perspective born of fiscal and geopolitical reality. This approach incurred the wrath of the American establishment, resulting in a single-term presidency and the ascension of Joe Biden to his status as American Commander-in-Chief. Now, this may be a little bit confusing to people because you think, well, what did Trump do with NATO? Well, he insisted that the European countries actually pay their fair share. European countries are all supposed to pay, I think, 2% of gross domestic product. And he was just insisting that NATO got its money. So, I mean, to Donald Trump, why would NATO be upset with him for trying to get their money to actually fund the project? What was really going on there, Matt? What did Trump do to upset NATO?
Well, I think one of the main things was pulling thousands of troops out of Germany. You don't have a presence, American presence in Europe to deter anybody. And of course, Russia has no interest in expanding westward. They don't have that capacity. Putin mentioned that again at the press conference after their meeting. That's you know, completely the invention of the American military and the neocons. So removing troops, demanding the money, and then of course, you know, making fun of these countries that don't even have militaries, bringing into the NATO alliance, the lack of political unity. He was very clear. Now, this is from a mainstream journal. I think this is from Foreign Policy. He certainly did not try to repair relations with Russia. He was harder on Russia than Obama ever was. But again, from a fiscal point of view, the U.S. is shouldering a massive burden against a non-existent enemy of the NATO alliance that's now all over the world, which was not in its initial charter, and failing anywhere it's gone. The Doha Agreement that I just published on my Patreon page is a surrender of the U.S. from Afghanistan. And it's been country after country after country. They've destroyed it. They've achieved nothing that they sought to achieve. And often the military has been defeated. So there's really not enough men there. And Trump was very vocal about a lot of this stuff. Maybe not the defeat part, but he didn't start a single war, which is incredible for an American politician.
Well, I think as soon as NATO went into Afghanistan, Russia was just laughing, quietly chuckling to herself because she knew what it was going to be like. She knew it was just going to grind the American forces down and cost a lot of money and not actually get anywhere. So I think they're quite happy for NATO to go into Afghanistan. But all of those countries are miles away from America. They're miles away from Europe. It's just a complete waste of money. Well, the reality check that followed Biden's impolite chest thumping, manifested by the withdrawal of Russia's ambassador and the snap mobilization of 100,000 Russian troops on Russia's border with Ukraine, drove home the reality that the US and its NATO allies were not in any position to confront Russia militarily. Moreover, more sober assessments coming out of both Europe and the US held that the rise of an expansionist China represented a greater threat to the geopolitical positioning of the transatlantic partnership than Russia. Now, we haven't heard about this for a while. I know Ukraine are always making a fuss about Russian troops on the border, but there was a big build-up recently, wasn't there, Matt? So what's currently happening in the Ukraine-Russia border?
Well, you know, the U.S. and its minions in the area are always engaging in military exercises, including in places like the Black Sea. Huge naval presence, huge air presence, building up the so-called Ukrainian military, usually with and the Georgian military, with mercenaries, among other things. The Russians engaged in local military exercises of their own in Russia, but close to the Ukrainian border. And it's been very clear, we're not going to take these things lying down, but they never went over the border. There was no threat to it. It wasn't that long ago the U.S. was claiming that Russia invaded Ukraine in 2014. The only invasion in world history that no one noticed. It's a complete invention. But these are Russian troops in Russia responding to a clear buildup of American forces in the area. And as far as I know, maybe 25,000 have been removed, but Russia is not taking this lying down.
Russia has every right to have its own troops on the border. I mean, that's exactly where they should be. That's doing exactly what the National Army should be doing, is protecting the country. It's the Western armies that are in the wrong place. Instead of actually protecting the country from illegal immigrants and fake refugees, they're playing around in Afghanistan and in disguise in Syria. Well, just before this this Putin-Biden summit, there was a NATO communique that was sent out. The US and its NATO allies regularly conduct military exercises in nations bordering China. The Khan Quest exercise in Mongolia, the Steppe Eagle exercise in Kazakhstan and in nearby Cambodia, Angkor Sentinel, as well as naval exercises with several neighbouring nations off China's coast. China has not threatened local nations for participating in those, but the NATO summit communique mentioned, for example, strengthening military ties with its partners across the globe and NATO members Japan, South Korea and Australia, while attacking China for engaging in military exercises with its neighbour, Russia. Neither has it threatened other Asia-Pacific nations for joining NATO military partnership programs, several of which nations border China, that's Afghanistan, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Mongolia, Pakistan and Tajikistan. China responded accordingly and quickly to the above writ of indictment, the communique coming from NATO. The spokesman of the nation's mission to the European Union, China doesn't have a mission to NATO, as many of its Asia-Pacific neighbours do, denied that China presents systemic challenges to other nations, much less to all of Europe and North America. I mean, what is NATO really doing in the South China Seas? I mean, it's called the South China Seas. Surely China should actually be within its own seas, but we're told that China is somehow a threat in the South China Seas, and yet you have all of China's neighbours here that are lining up to join up with NATO, and NATO is criticising China for going on manoeuvres with Russia, which is actually one of its neighbours. What's going on here, Matt?
Well, you have plenty of allies, the Chinese, all over the place. You know, they can play both sides against the other, what the Third World did during the Cold War, for example. But this is the typical ideology of empire. They can do as they please. Any response will be condemned as aggression. You know, it's almost like a certain like narcissism in with an individual. But these systemic challenges, that's NATO's term that China presents, is, of course, you know, political influence, economic influence, military modernization and ideology. But China has been very successful in modernizing the country in a non-liberal way, which is exactly what in a Han nationalist kind of way, Eurasian kind of a way, which is something that embarrasses the American political system as it heads even deeper into bankruptcy. So that's the challenge. China isn't doing anything that the U.S. or Great Britain hadn't done in the past, but they're doing it within their own neighborhood. They're engaging in any kind of trade deals, just like any other country would, and it's seen as somehow military aggression when they do this. They offer loans at lower interest without political riders attached to them, because these aren't for-profit banks. These are usually the state, because the state controls banks there. It's a completely different situation. It's a state-controlled currency, so you don't have this arrogant banker class. They're demanding concessions from everyone, and essentially, it's projection. They're everything that they're doing, they externalize and blame the Chinese for doing. The Chinese have a military budget a tenth of the U.S. because they don't have bases all over the planet. They don't have an empire. They're not overstretched. They're highly motivated, and the U.S. is not a military superpower anymore. And the nature of the challenge is what happens when you have a dying empire facing a vigorous younger opponent.
That's interesting. They say it's a systemic challenge. And what they actually mean is that the system that China has is showing by actions that it is superior to the system in the West. And that's because it is based on doing what is best for the Chinese. I mean, it may be called Communist China, but it's essentially Nationalist China because it's 99.9% Chinese. China already has a blood debt to settle with NATO, one it has never forgotten, for the military bloc's killing of three journalists and the wounding of 27 other Chinese in Belgrade in 1999. And that's the first, I think, that I've actually heard of that. You think, well, NATO's killed some Chinese. You would think that would be over in China. So what were the Chinese doing in Belgrade? What was actually happening him at, where NATO took out, 30 Chinese people in one go?
This was in May of 1999, during the bombing of Yugoslavia. This was a direct attack on the Chinese embassy in the capital. There was a claim that the U.S. made a mistake, that the buildings looked similar to a communications center nearby. There was the U.K. Observer and a Dutch newspaper did their own investigation, showing that it was very deliberate, blaming the maps for being out of date. Was ridiculous because a software company that put the maps together said, no, it's nothing of the kind. This was even they're saying it's a deliberate attack. It was a way to send a message to the Chinese. It clearly was a deliberate surgical attack on the Chinese embassy. And it didn't get a whole lot of media coverage, but it inflamed Chinese opinion beyond belief. It was an incredibly stupid thing to do.
So it was actually the embassy that they took out. But why would they go for the embassy? Surely China should have an embassy in every country. I mean, isn't that just diplomatic protocol? Unless you're actually at war with a country or they're under sanction, you have an embassy there. I mean, what was the point in attacking the China embassy? To say you shouldn't have an embassy in Serbia? Surely not.
Well, then they began to say in a contradictory way that, well, they were supporting the Yugoslav government. Which, of course, they were, therefore making them combatants. So they went from denying it happened, even giving money to the families, and then saying, well, but if we did do it, it's because they were supporting Yugoslavia, and therefore that's an enemy target. Their explanations were contradictory all over the place. But it's very clear this was a punishment for them being opposed to, and this is 99. It's when the color revolution stuff was first getting started. Yugoslavia almost a test case, seeing how much they can get away with there. China was standing in the way, and that was their punishment.
So the West may have forgotten about it, but China certainly hasn't. China has come in for an unrelenting barrage of insults and vilification from NATO in the months leading up to the summit. In response to these charges against China, the Global Times had this to say. This NATO summit can be seen as a key point in the US and Europe's attitude towards China in the security arena. Washington has raised the curtain for a political mobilization campaign to use the NATO bloc to carry out strategic competition with China. The EU mission's spokesperson's comment also included a reminder that China's defense budget for this year is $209 billion, which is 1.35 trillion yuan. Which is 1.3% of the Chinese gross domestic product, less even than the 2% demanded of NATO member states. In contrast, the 30-member NATO alliance has a total military spending as high as $1.17 trillion, making up over half of the global sum and 5.6 times that of China. The statement also mentioned that the world, who knows which countries' military bases stretch all over the world and whose aircraft carriers are wandering around to flex their military muscle. It also recalled that the US alone has almost 20 times the amount of nuclear weapons as China does and invited NATO to match China's commitment to the no first use of nuclear weapons and unconditionally not using or threatening to use nuclear weapons against non-nuclear weapons states or zones. And one knows what the answer to that offer will be. The response to NATO also contained words particularly worth heeding. China has been committed to peaceful development, but will never forget the tragedy of the bombing of the Chinese embassy in Yugoslavia, nor the sacrifices of our compatriots' homes and lives. We will unswervingly defend our sovereignty and development interests and keep a close eye on NATO's strategic adjustments and policies towards China. So they're being quite upfront that they're not having this, but they're not actually making any threats back. They're just sort of responding by saying, well, look, we're the people that actually want peace. You're the ones that refuse to acknowledge our anti-nuclear agreement. What do you make of what's being said here, Matt, and how does it directly affect the West?
Well, it could affect the West if war breaks out, a war that the U.S. couldn't possibly win. If it can't win in Afghanistan, it certainly can't win against China, especially in alliance with Russia and Iran and many other places. The world's market is concentrated in East Asia. It's growing and largely state-centric. There's not much you could do. You know, China is in Iraq. It has nuclear weapons. It's I think the economy is actually larger than the U.S. when you consider goods being created rather than just financial services. I think the U.S. defense budget is far higher than the on budget, whatever it is, $700 billion. I think it's much higher than that because there's a lot of off-budget things and parts of the budget in different departments that aren't included in it. And again, China hasn't expanded anywhere. They haven't what the U.S. is doing with Tibet and Xinjiang, inflaming opinion there, creating these terror groups, sending ISIS in. I mean, this has been a declaration of war for a very long time. But the Chinese government, like the Russian government, are well aware that they're looking for someone to shoot back. So the military is under strict orders not to engage because that's exactly what they want. It's a suicide mission. The U.S. simply can't win in this respect. I have article after article going on how the U.S. military is literally falling apart, claiming they don't have enough money, corruption at all levels, no standards, no merit-based promotions. They go up against an enemy like this, it's going to be very ugly. The only time China has made any kind of threat at all, it was over the Taiwan issue, which is also inflamed by the U.S. China doesn't threaten its neighbors. The U.S. does it all the time and far beyond its borders.
Well, one thing they mentioned there is that could set things off is if something threatens their development interests. And one of the outcomes, I think, of the G7 was that they were going to come up with their own alternatives to the Belt and Road Initiative. Did you hear anything about that, Matt? Have you had any thoughts on that, the G7 alternative to the Belt and Road Initiative?
Yeah, I did. It's a multi-trillion-dollar infrastructure project, highly unlikely to pass even at the legislature, let alone anything else. The money simply isn't there. And the fact is that globally, China's model makes a lot more sense. China is a very successful country that went from third world to first world status in 20 years. You can't imagine any other government doing that in China. These other factions are simply tools of corporate America. And they're, as I mentioned, their interest rates are much lower. It's a state-centered financial system rather than a private, for-profit one. They don't have, you know, their concepts of peaceful coexistence. The center of their foreign policy is mutual respect for territorial integrity and sovereignty and non-aggression. They have no interest in, you know, harming their own economy by engaging in any kind of warfare, which is why the whole Wuhan leak nonsense is so irrational. They're doing anything to inflame Western opinion against the Chinese, a system that they know very little about, thinking that it's still Marxist or racist in the case when they're talking to the left, trying to get both sides on board for a war with one of the other countries. This is going to be a disaster, but you have to admit China's patience and restraint has been almost superhuman.
Well, they're setting a very good example, aren't they? Going from first world status to third world status to first world status, as you say, so quickly. And I guess when these third world countries, when they look at how America is doing right now with all the political troubles, you can see the example that they're going to want to follow. We're not content to have dragooned almost the entire European continent into its ranks, to have waged wars of aggression against countries in three continents, none of them remotely near the Euro-Atlantic area, and recruited 40 partners to add to its 30 members. NATO is now challenging and confronting China. An opinion piece in China Daily called No Enemy, NATO Will Create One, had this to say about NATO's throwing down the gauntlet to China. of moving from one adversary to another, from the Soviet Union to Yugoslavia to Libya to China. By imposing their role of imaginary enemy upon China, NATO is hurting the interests of the whole world, its own members included. And the only side that benefits is NATO itself, because it finds an excuse to continue existing and spending the $2.5 billion collected from Western taxpayers' pockets. I suspect it's more than that, Matt. What do you make of their figure here? $2.5 billion is how much NATO costs.
Yeah, well, as far as the whole alliance is concerned, I guess $2.5 billion in terms of the administrative offices. But of course, we know what their combined budget is. And their combined budget is actually much higher than on paper. I've decided to put a book together defending China's foreign policy. Because, you know, Johnson's law being what it is, the regime simply can invent whatever it pleases. Not a whole lot of people know enough to refute it. And so you create this irrational hatred in people's minds about, you know, China taking over everything when it's doing no different than any other great power has done. China has far more of a claim to be a superpower than the U.S. does. The U.S. doesn't have any money. China has so much gold, it could just not have an economy for years and be perfectly okay. Russia's in the same boat. The alliance with Russia is extremely strong. So, you know, again, as the title of the article says, no enemy, NATO will create one. And that's exactly what this is. They tried to do it with the Islamic world, but they were making too many alliances with it. They found it too useful, supporting them all over the place. China and Russia, most people are ignorant about it. They have a vaguely sinister connotation. And I guarantee you, anything happens, there will be no anti-war movement. That only happens when the enemy is communist. When it's nationalist, there's not going to be any anti-war movement.
Well, let's have a look at the NBC Putin interview, because this anti-China bias was quite apparent in that as well. In its exclusive interview with Putin, NBC News devoted much of it to questions about China, and Keir Simmons tried to make Putin at least say a few bad things about China, but he failed. The questions from Simmons covered the potential threat of China's rising military strength towards Russia, China's absence from the US-Russia nuclear arms control negotiations, China's Xinjiang affairs, Russia's cooperation in the space program with China and the US, and even the hypothetical question of what would Russia do if China solves the Taiwan question militarily. Simmons said, China, for example, abstained on Crimea at the Security Council. China's biggest banks have not contravened American sanctions against Russia. Do you think you get 100% support from China? Putin responded, according to NBC, can I be completely honest? We can see attempts at destroying the relationship between Russia and China. We can see that those attempts are being made in practical policies, and your questions too have to do with this. So he's basically pointing out that the mainstream media is just doing, it's in a lockstep with the government. It's supposed to be questioning these things, not working as an arm of the government. And the government itself is obviously an arm of these corporations, unlike in countries like Russia and China, where they're actually doing what's best for their people. What do you make of this NBC Putin interview, Matt?
Well, it must have been 2005, 2006. I first made the argument that the greatest nightmare of global liberalism is an alliance between Russia and China, and that the American press was doing everything in its power to create issues between the two of them, claiming they're not really allies, they're enemies, almost like it's a certain kind of wish fulfillment. And it turns out, you know, it's absolutely right. And they're trying to get him to say negative things, Chinese to say negative things about Russia. Chinese banks have most certainly contravened sanctions against Russia. They do it all the time. Why would China care about that? China did abstain on the Crimea issue out of a principle of non-interference. That was strictly an inter-Russian problem, according to them. And then they poured money into investment into Crimea once it was done, once the referendum was done. So clearly they support it. So this was, you know, a loaded, you know, nonsensical question from a journalistic class that really doesn't know much about the topic. The Taiwan question I have no idea what Russia would probably would support them one way or another. But I don't think that's going to happen. It would be too bloody. So Putin is absolutely right. That nightmare that keeps liberals up at night, the Russia-China alliance, is kind of like the possible alliance between Russia and Germany before World War I. Absolutely nightmarish for liberalism. And they're going to do everything they can to invent issues, have double agents, whatever it takes to make them enemies.
Well, let's have a look at what China thinks of all this. Such attempts made by Simmons as well as by US policymakers look extremely hilarious, useless, and too obvious, said Chinese analysts. Lu Zhiyang, a research fellow in US studies at the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences in Beijing, told the Global Times that Biden knows that kind of attempt won't work, but he will try his best. This is the biggest goal that he wants to reach from the meeting with Putin. The US has nothing to offer Russia in exchange for abandoning its relations with Beijing and betraying China, while the Russians have a very unfortunate and painful memory of being betrayed and fooled by the US, said experts. Jin Kanrong, Associate Dean of the School of International Studies at the Renmin University of China, said there is no chance for the US to entirely change the direction of US-Russia relations from confrontation to cooperation. The most Biden could get is to slow down the worsening trend. What is the very unfortunate and painful memory of being betrayed by America that is being referred to here, Matt?
Well, not just America, but the West. I mean, we could start with the end of World War I, support of the Bolsheviks during the Civil War, the American support of the oligarchs in the 1990s in Russia, pulling out of every treaty and agreement that the U.S. had with the Soviet Union, and then, of course, the Russian Federation. It's one thing after another. The relationship between the two countries, Russia and China, is mutually profitable. They're similar ideologies. They're, you know, vehemently anti-liberal. They're opposed to American and Western imperialism. You know, they're on the right side of this, and their population and economies are huge and very diverse. They're almost they don't need anybody else. They have everything they need, highly skilled, highly educated people. The U.S. doesn't offer anything, as it says. Abandoning China, why? They make billions in energy sales there, huge bilateral trade. Why would they change this? The U.S., China really getting to the point now, it just doesn't even need the U.S. much anymore. It has its markets elsewhere, and that's very frightening for American policymakers.
You know, really, all that ethnically homogenous Russia and ethnically homogenous China have to do is just sit back and wait for ethnically multicultural America to just pull itself apart. I'm sure they're just laughing already. You can see them smirking as they're looking at Biden and thinking, you know, how can you put this man forward? He's obviously a puppet and your country is on its knees and you're trying to project power. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Matt. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I'll be back tomorrow with Grandpa Dan. God bless and hail victory.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.